Welcome to Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, here's the number to call, 1-800-462-7413. And, of course, along with your calls, some topics to talk over, Zorba?
Yes, sleepiness. Americans are sleepier than Europeans. Shocking, isn't it? Not really, but we're heavier, we're sleepier. Interesting data, interesting research about this.
Mm-hmm. And?
And we're going to talk about obese kids. 2 out of 3 very obese kids already have risk factors for heart disease in childhood. In other words, they're kids, they're overweight, they're already showing signs of heart disease. What should we do about it? It's a major problem.
And what's our recipe?
Lamb Rogan Josh. It's delicious. If you love lamb, you got to try it.
And that one comes to us from guest chef Sally B., who will be on the line with us from Great Britain. That's coming up. That toll-free number, 800-462-7413. 800-462-7413. And a listener now in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Hi.
Hello.
What's up?
Well, I guess the reason for my call is I have been taking over-the-counter sleep medication for probably 2 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I'm just concerned if I should be worried about taking it. I started out and I just, you know, took the 50 milligram diphenhydramine pill, and it slowly started to stop working, so I'm now up to 300 milligrams every night before I go to sleep.
How long has this process been going on?
Close to 2 years now, probably.
So 300 milligrams, that's a lot of antihistamine. Doesn't it make your mouth kind of dry?
Yes, it does.
Yeah, I mean that's a lot. That's a lot of antihistamine, and I mean it's not going to destroy your body in any way. But obviously, it's not working very well if you have to go above 50 milligrams. And that's what happens. What happens is the over-the-counter sleeping medicines are almost all universally diphenhydramine, which is Benadryl, mm-hmm. generic Benadryl. And the side effect of generic Benadryl is sleepiness. So what happens is many people adjust to it, which is what you did. So you needed then 50 milligrams. And 100 milligrams and 200 milligrams. You know, there are better
right.
drugs on the market that may work for you that aren't over the counter and are not addictive. So, what do you do for a living?
Well, I work at my house. I'm
okay.
a designer.
Mm-hmm.
I do a lot of graphic design and stuff
okay.
like that.
Okay. So, at your house, and what time you normally go to sleep?
Well, lately it's been around 2 o'clock.
2 o'clock, and that's okay. I mean, if I were left to my druthers, I'd go to sleep at two. But what time do you have to wake up? You're a designer; it doesn't matter, or does it?
It just depends. Sometimes I'll have meetings in the morning, but generally, if I just naturally wake up whenever uh-huh. I finally decide to get out of bed, it's usually around 10.
Around 10 o'clock. Okay, so I mean that, you know, that's so that's it.
And
that's
I'm usually
it.
Really asleep. Groggy around
uh-huh.
that time.
Okay, around that. Well, I'm not surprised. You're taking all that Benadryl.
Yeah.
You would be groggy. Well, I've got a couple suggestions. First of all, I want you to go, and we'll give a link on our website, zorbapastor.org. We're going to give you a link of a good sleep hygiene site. So if you come to zorbapastor.org, we'll give you a link there. Because sleep hygiene is making sure your room is right. It talks about pillows, how dark it should be, the temperature. You want to be able to look at all of the non-drug ways of attending to sleep hygiene. In other words, what's the best way to do it? Now, number two, you got to get off the Benadryl. It's way too much, and it's
yeah.
not working, frankly. And the yeah. way to get off of it is because there are no side effects of stopping it, as I would just stop it. That's
yeah.
what I would do. You might go to 150 milligrams for a day or two, but frankly, I'd stop the Benadryl. I'd get it out of the house so that I'm not going to take it. And then I would plan on not falling asleep for the first night. That's what will happen. In other
yeah.
words, you won't go to sleep at 2. You'll say, I can't go to sleep, and you won't go to sleep at 3. And you'll kind of doze. But one of the things we do with sleep hygiene is we induce a little hypersleepiness by staying up later. So if you normally go to sleep at 2, what I would do is I'd stop it on a day you don't have to work, and I would try to go to sleep at 4 or 6 in the morning. In other
okay.
words, just try to stay up. So
starving
you can
myself asleep.
Yeah, basically, that's mm-hmm. what you do. Then go through sleep hygiene, see if you can do it without drugs. If not, the drug that I recommend today is gabapentin, G-A-B-A-P-E-N-T-I-N, gabapentin, also under the name Neurontin. It's a drug that was initially designed for seizures. It works with people with chronic pain, and it's really a very, very good drug to help people sleep. It's not addictive, and for many people, it works well, 300 to 600 milligrams at bedtime. Need a prescription for it. But first, I would do, and it's not addictive, like I said, that's the issue. But first, I would do sleep hygiene and see if that works, and get off the Benadryl. It's going to make you groggy the next day because it's a lot of milligrams.
Yeah.
A lot of milligrams, so.
Thank you guys so much.
We appreciate the call at 1-800-462-7413. Probably a good time now, Zorba, to work in that sleep study.
Yes, the sleep study. Well, Americans, you know, accused of, there are a lot of things Americans do. You know, we're heavier and we're louder and we're ruder compared to the Europeans, although certainly not the Brits, but maybe the rest on the continent. But this, it's sort of an interesting survey, but I have to tell you afterwards who did the survey. It showed that about 20% of Americans are sleepy and they have moderate to excessive sleepiness during the day and they have trouble staying awake on their job and meetings and in conversations. I mean, I can believe that because there are lots of studies that show that we're sleep deprived. What bothers me is the study was funded by a company that makes Provigil, and Provigil is a drug that's designed to keep you awake for people who have daytime sleepiness. Now, I cannot imagine that this study is at all biased because it was funded by a company called Cephalon that makes Provigil. Yeah. I mean, it must be.
Right. We all
exactly.
know.
On the other hand, sometimes studies like this, if you realize that there is a bias to it, even if the study is scientifically sound, you know, it was questioned.
So what do they say?
Well, they say we don't get enough sleep and basically produces sleepiness throughout
the
day. Well, yeah, that is kind of the end of the story. But actually, the end of the story is we talk about we don't get enough sleep.
Yeah.
And I think it reminds us again that sleep is a very important part of our 24-hour cycle. There are good studies that show that people who don't get enough sleep are heavier. In other words, they eat more and they weigh more. That people who don't get enough sleep do not do as well at work, obviously. And people who don't get enough sleep do not exercise as much. So I think one of the things we have to do in America is we're always talking about diet and exercise, right? Mm-hmm. Well, we should be talking about diet, exercise, and sleep. Maybe it should be those three. Maybe it should be eating the right food, exercising at least 3 to 4 days a week, and trying to get 8 hours of sleep and really succeeding in 7 hours most of the time.
Yeah. My guess is that there isn't a certain number. Like we say 8 hours of sleep at night, but some people really can get along on 6 hours of sleep.
6 or 7. Well, what you do is you see what your natural sleep pattern is. Yeah. Most people need 7 to 8 hours of sleep. Some people can need 9, and some people need 6.
I mean, you could ask, do you get enough sleep to 10 people? Yeah. And one would say, no, I don't. I only sleep 9 hours a night.
That's
another
right.
would say,
well, how much sleep do you need?
Well, I used to think I could do fine on 5 or 6 hours a night.
Oh, gosh.
But
what do you need?
I went through years where I didn't get much more sleep than that, but now I'm sleeping pretty well.
Yeah, how much sleep do you get?
About 8 hours now.
Oh, see, now I can't get by to 5 or 6 hours. Oh, you know what? You used to get by on much less sleep years ago.
Yeah.
That explains why your personality changed. Once you got more sleep, you became much more pleasant, much more enjoyable.
Now, wait a minute.
Much
what
friendlier.
Wait a minute. You say I was not a pleasant person?
And that's the rest of the story.
Okay, 800-462-7413. We're going to take another phone call now. This one comes from a listener in Jacksonville, Florida. Hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Fine. How do you sleep?
I sleep like a baby.
That's good.
That's 8 hours every night.
That's not why you called then.
8 hours every night. Yeah. We go.
How can we help?
Recently lost close to 70 pounds.
Oh, congratulations.
Diet and exercise. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
It's been a lot of work. But that has led me to registering for a marathon. And in my beginning stages of training, I'm finding out I don't know how to eat training for this marathon.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I just feel like the balance is off. I'm hungry often. I'm not sure how much protein, how much carbohydrates I need to be taking in. And I just feel like every 2 hours, it's like, I got to eat.
So you want to know what you should do in order to set up your meal planning, right, for your marathon?
without putting that 70 pounds back on.
Exactly. Now, how'd you take it off? Weight Watchers, watching your carbs, watching the fat. What'd you watch? How'd you do it?
I have done Weight Watchers kind of modified, I guess.
Okay.
If you want to put it that way.
That's because the reality is what you need to eat, especially when you're running a marathon, you have to have a good amount of protein. Very important. You need 60 grams of protein probably. You might even do better with even 70 grams of protein. There's very good evidence that when we begin to limit ourselves, for instance, from one thing such as carbs or fat, that we end up craving that thing which we limit ourselves. So I am against now a totally low-fat diet because I think the low-fat diet in America has failed. I mean, it's clear we've embraced low fat for the last 20 years and we porked on for the last 20 years. I mean, as we embraced low fat, we failed. And my good buddy Dan, who might be listening at this particular time, years ago, got on the Atkins diet because he said fat is more satisfying. And I think he's right. I think that for many people, fat is satisfying. But all fat is not satisfying either. Otherwise, you'd see all these Atkins people walking around and they would be thin. So the answer for you is moderation. Now, on the day of the run, I think you should carbohydrate load for a day or two before because there's good evidence that that may give you some enough glycogen in your liver to give you that extra boost when you're running. But I think you need a balanced meal plan. And I'll tell you, I like Weight Watchers. I don't own the stock, but I think they've got a meal plan that is dynamite because it's balanced. And I think that's really the goal. You can't eat every 2 hours. If you do that, what's going to happen is you're going to put on that 70 pounds. Yeah. And it's that habit issue.
Now, how's the training going? How far are you running now?
Right now I'm up to 15 to 20 miles a week. On my long runs, I do 7 miles.
Cool.
Six or seven miles.
Are you going to be doing the full marathon or half marathon?
Full marathon.
Full marathon.
Yeah. You've really changed your life around, haven't you?
I have. I just kind of got to a point where I just felt like I had no choice.
Now, what motivated you? Like you said, you had no choice. What is it? It always interests me how there are doers and don'ters. There are people that do take action and people that don't take action. What motivated you to make that change?
It may sound shallow, but I just didn't like what I saw in the mirror, and I wasn't okay with that.
I don't think that's shallow at all. I think anything that motivates you to good health is absolutely there, and I think if you feel good and you look good and you feel better about yourself, that counts. That is not shallow. That was your modus operandi. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, and you're looking good now.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks for the call.
I feel it. Thank you.
800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. On we go to Platteville, Wisconsin now. Hello.
Hi, Dr. Zorba. This is Amanda.
Mm-hmm. What's up?
I have just a little bit of drink. I don't drink beer because I can't stand the taste of it, but like a wine cooler or anything like that, just a sip of it. And all of a sudden, my feet will become tingly, feel like someone's tickling them, and then become numb. What can I do for that?
Well, numb. Do they stay numb? Or?
They stay numb until the alcohol comes out of my system.
Go away. Really?
Yep.
You ever hear about that, Zora?
Tom is absolutely shocked. His mouth has dropped.
Well, I never
You know, Tom, how much do you drink, Tom? I've never asked you. Do you drink very often?
Not that often.
Not that often.
Beer or two a week.
Maybe a glass of wine.
And I only drink like maybe once every 2 months. I don't really drink that often.
So, in other words, once every 2 months, you have a wine cooler and your feet go numb.
Yes.
That is a strange side effect.
Well, now, you were just talking about how weird it was that I reacted. You're reacting the same way. What's that? You've never told me, Zorba, how much do you drink?
I don't drink that much. I have a couple of glasses of wine a week, a couple of beers a week, and a rum and coke. Lately, I've been into rum and coke.
On vacation for me when I'm south.
A rum and coke, yeah. Well, I think that's why I took it, when it's a nice day or a nice night. Yeah. But getting back to this, that is an unusual side effect. So let's go back. Have you tried, you don't like the taste of beer. So have you tried different kinds of alcohol to see if it's alcohol?
I've tried mixed drinks. I've tried hard liquor, soft liquor, wine coolers. Pretty much if you need it, I've tried it.
Okay, so you've had different things. Because sometimes people actually react to what the drink is made of. So we know that's not the case. Face turns red. Does your face turn red? Does your pulse go up at all? No.
Nope.
Cough at all or sweating?
No. Nope.
Nausea or vomiting at all associated with it? Okay,
because I have never had a hangover ever.
You've never had a hangover. Well, with numbness in your feet, you're never going to be an alcoholic either. That's pretty obvious because you wouldn't be able to walk. So you want to be able to go out and enjoy a drink and not have this thing occur. And what is it? I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is. But I have some suggestions because being a doctor, we can always give advice even when we don't know what's going on. It's the advantage of medicine. Give advice even when you're not. If you do it with conviction, maybe the patient will get better. And if not, you know, well, you tried your best. But sometimes these are unusual reactions to the alcohol itself. So you might try this. You might try taking an antihistamine before you actually go out and you have a drink. And I would try over-the-counter Claritin, generic, because it's cheaper. I would take one or two tablets. That's 10 or 20 milligrams. They come in tens. 10 or 20 milligrams of Claritin and just see if that does it. That's one thing I would try. If that doesn't do it, I would take it with an aspirin, because sometimes an aspirin, which is an anti-prostaglandin drug, sometimes one aspirin will do it. I would take that at least 1 hour before drinking and see if that works. That's what I would do. There is a prescription drug rather called Singular, Singular, that sometimes will also work in patients who can't tolerate alcohol. But usually these are people who flush and have a flush reaction. And that's a 10 milligram tablet, and I would try that. But first I would try the over-the-counter and see if it works, so you can go out and have a wine cooler with your friends.
Thank you very much. It's greatly appreciated.
Good luck. Good luck.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
What was that? What's that drink that doesn't have a... Oh, Shirley Temple. She could have a Shirley Temple.
With no alcohol.
Yeah. Do they still call it a Shirley Temple, do you think?
Nobody knows who Shirley Temple is.
That's what I mean. You wouldn't even know who Shirley Temple is. Shirley who? Shirley Temple.
Well, Zorba, now that your advice-giving gears are greased, let's put them to the test with another edition of Rapid Fire. Are you ready?
I am ready, Tom.
Shane from Madison, Wisconsin, who's a sinus sufferer and a neti pot enthusiast, kicks things off by asking, is there a limit to the amount of times I can use my neti pot per day?
Well, the answer is no. You can use it as often as you want to, but it might interfere with the rest of your life if you're simply pouring saline in and out of your nose.
I don't think he means 24/7.
Well, he said he wanted to know the limits. Those are the limits, limits.
Speaking of sinus trouble, Zorba, Scott from Utah writes in to ask, I'm a painter and an art teacher and spend a lot of time around various solvents. Could exposure to odorless mineral spirits and turpentine be making my allergies worse?
Yes, absolutely. They could be making it worse. And the answer is you want to protect yourself and make sure that there's enough ventilation in the room that you're using it, because even though it's odorless, it still has an odor.
Let's move on to Mary in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, who heard your advice about warm milk as a sleeping aid. She's lactose intolerant and wondering if there's an alternative.
Absolutely. She can use lactate-infused milk. Therefore, the enzyme is in the milk, which digests the milk sugar. She can warm it up and have a good night's sleep and sleep like a baby.
Leon would like to know what you recommend for cleaning produce before eating.
I recommend water. Water is the best way to clean produce. You mean versus like alcohol or one of those solvents that we use like Purell on our hands? No, just plain.
Well, do you need to brush it? Do you need to...
Copious amounts of water with gentle cleaning. That's what you do. If it's a mushroom, I would recommend a brush.
Penny from Cadillac, Michigan needs you to set her straight about calcium and vitamin C when she asks, do I have to spread my vitamins out over the whole day, which I'm likely to forget, or can I continue to take them all at breakfast?
You know, that is a good question. A lot of people ask that question, and the answer is you can take your vitamins all at the same time. It doesn't matter. And some people take them at breakfast. You know when I take my vitamins, Tom?
At breakfast.
At bedtime.
Oh.
I take it at bedtime. I can't remember to take it at breakfast. And you want to know why?
Why?
I don't eat breakfast.
Oh. Breakfast is the most important meal of the day.
That's exactly it.
I'd spend 10 minutes on this with you, but this is rapid fire. Finally, George from Wisconsin Rapids writes in to tell us that he's got the perfect book for a male midlife crisis. the Corvette's owner's manual.
Go, boy, go.
But that's for an expensive midlife crisis. We're out of time for this edition of Rapid Fire, but make sure to get your question in for our next round. Just send your email to
Zorba at WPR.org.
Stick around for our recipe, this one coming to us from England. We have more calls for you, of course, some more interesting research, our medical myth buster, too, here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. A call for Zorba? We have an open line for you right now. 1-800-462-7413. But of course, before our next call, recipe time. And today we have a very special guest chef joining us from across the pond. Would you please welcome Sally B., author of The Secret Ingredient, Delicious, Easy, Heart-Healthy Recipes That Might Just Save Your Life. Now, in addition to being the spokeswoman for the British Heart Foundation, Sally is the mother of three, and I'm happy to report that all the recipes in The Secret Ingredient are kid-approved and family-friendly. So, we'll feature now a lamb recipe from the book. It's the recipe for lamb Rogan Josh. Sally, welcome to the Zorba Pastor on Your Health Radio Kitchen.
Oh, thank you. How are you two?
We're both great. Now, how did you happen to come up with lamb Rogan Josh?
Well, I've had to come up with a lot of recipes that are really seriously tasty and enticing for me and the family to eat that are all health. Particularly heart-healthy dishes, because I unfortunately suffered heart attacks almost 6 years ago at a very young age.
Oh my goodness! How old were you when you had your heart attacks? Tell us about it.
I was 36 at the time.
Oh my goodness!
And I have three young children. At the time, the children were 4, 2, and 9 months old. And I have to say, I didn't have the heart attacks because I was an unhealthy eater before. Mm-hmm. I actually survived the heart attacks because I was a healthy eater. But after the event, and I was getting better and trying to get my strength back, and at the same time, I was sitting at the table with these three little rat bags who were hungry and wanted mummy to provide something gorgeous and tasty to them, and I needed to provide something gorgeous and healthy for me. I just started to develop recipes which were steeped and stacked with flavor and taste and deliciousness, but were good for the heart as well.
Yeah, great. Now, I know what lamb is, but I have no idea what Rogan Josh means. What is that?
Do you not? This is a really popular Indian dish here in the UK. A Rogan Josh is, if we were going out for an Indian meal, this is something that the children would have probably because it's very delicate flavor. It's not a hot curry. It's a very mild flavor, but it still has flavor in it. But what happens often with Indian food and the same with Chinese food, it has too much fat, it has too much salt, and it has monosodium glutamate and things like that, which don't work well with a dodgy ticker, work well with a poorly heart. So again, I've had to find different ways and different ingredients to use where you still get the same flavor, because life is too short to live forever on mung beans and spinach. You want those gorgeous flavors, but just without the naughties.
Okay, so you guys, you two, put this one together, and while you're doing it, I'm going to fantasize about eating it, and I may chime in.
I think it's great, but I love the concept. Life is too short to live on mung beans and spinach.
You got it.
I definitely agree with you on that. So let's go through the recipe a bit, then we'll chat. Well, so we start out with 1 pound of lamb steaks or more cubed lamb, a lamb that you would have cubed, correct?
Yeah, that's right. But make sure you cut off all the visible fat from the lamb. We don't do meat fat at all. That needs to be gone from it. So I go to a reputable butcher and buy lamb that you know where it's come from and say, please cut off all the fat, and any that's left there, you cut that off, and then you're good to go.
Yeah, and that's important because lamb is a meat, a red meat, that tends to have a lot of fat on it. I mean, that's
right.
Just the nature of it.
And I have to just say, in my book, I have dishes are marked as everyday dishes or treats dishes. Now, this is marked as an everyday because it's very low in fat. But then also, just try to limit red meat to once or twice a week is the healthy way to eat.
Right. And we'll go through that. We've got some other recipes that I think are great. 2 tablespoonfuls of olive oil.
Uh-huh.
1 onion peeled and finely chopped.
Mm-hmm.
3 cloves of garlic peeled and finely chopped.
Yeah.
Which is good. And then 1 each of what? One red bell pepper deseeded and finely chopped. So you mean minced or just sort of
chopped? Just finely chopped, yeah.
Oh, okay.
I mean, if you like them bigger, you can do them bigger.
Okay, depends on what you like in terms of texture. And then 1 teaspoon each of ground coriander, paprika, ground ginger, and chili powder. So 1 teaspoon each of coriander, paprika, ginger, ground ginger, and chili powder. That certainly adds the nice, gentle flavored spice in there.
Yeah.
A 14-ounce can of chopped tomatoes.
Tomatoes. We should be singing that song, shouldn't we? You say tomato, I say tomatoes.
Yeah. Actually, and my grandparents were on one side, were English, so this was actually a discussion that we would have all the time at the table, I remember as a child. A bay leaf. A three-quarter inch pieces of cinnamon sticks. So how many cinnamon sticks do you put in here?
Two of those.
Okay.
Two
cinnamon sticks. 4 cardamom pods. Cardamom pods. Tom, where do you get your cardamom pods?
Well, what's cardamom?
It's just another sort of spicy spice, really. There you go, spicy spice.
That's
They will just add flavor into there. This all just goes to give you this lovely, authentic Indian flavor.
Right. Yeah, cardamom is very... 3 cloves. So 3 cloves. 1 teaspoon of sugar. Notice how there's so little sugar in here at all.
You need that tiny little bit because that brings the flavor out of the tomatoes, but that's actually all that you need.
So that little teaspoon of sugar is really critical, and that's it. 3/4 of a cup of chicken stock, and some fresh cilantro.
Now, I have a question, Sally. What of these ingredients makes this a Rogan Josh?
It's really the flavor mix that you've got there, the coriander, the paprika, the ginger, and the chili powder. And then mixing it with the cinnamon stick, which, if you can imagine, does add a little bit of sort of sweetness to it, and the cardamom pods as well. So it's just that mix of those spices that give it the Rogan Josh. And also because it's got the tomato, it is a tomato-based sauce rather than a sort of Indian gravy-based sauce.
Or tomato.
Okay, so remove all the visible, we're going to make it now, remove all the visible fat from the lamb steaks, cut into 1-inch cubes. Then in a large frying pan over medium heat, warm the olive oil, add the onion, garlic, and red pepper, and a sauté. Fry for about 4 to 5 minutes until they're starting to soften. Next, add all of the powdered spices and fry for a minute, and in a little water if it becomes a bit too dry. Then add the lamb, the tomatoes, the bay leaf, the pieces of cinnamon, the cardamom, that's pronounced the same way, clove, sugar, and stock, and simmer over medium-low heat until it's reduced and thickened. About how long do you simmer it for to reduce it and thicken it? How long does that usually take?
Well, it depends. It's normally about 20 minutes, but you'll get a feel as you're cooking it, you know, when it becomes the right texture for you. Some people, depending on what they serve it with, some people like it more watery, more runny. I prefer it a little thicker. So until it's a desired consistency, which is normally about 20 minutes.
Okay, so you simmer it to the consistency that you like. Then
chop
the cilantro, stir it in, and serve with freshly steamed veggies. I think that sounds absolutely wonderful.
Delicious.
When we do an analysis, it's roughly 300 calories for each serving, which is not a lot of calories. calories for that. And you've got some wonderful recipes in your book, The Secret Ingredient, Sally B. by Sally B. Spicy poached pear, some wonderful dessert recipes, orange and peach phyllo recipe, which is here, some drinks, fish in a bag, which looks really, really interesting to me, glazed sweet potatoes with ginger. I love sweet potatoes. And as you say, I like the fact that you've got everyday recipes and treat recipes, because in America, we sometimes treat ourselves every day, and that's why we're overweight. We treat ourselves
too much.
Well,
the thing is, people also have this opinion that you can either eat tasty, gorgeous food or you're on a diet. And actually, I prove that that's rubbish. You can eat for health and nutrition, and at the same time, it will be gorgeous and delicious food. And for some people, certainly for me, it's not a lifestyle choice. It is a life or death choice, food that I eat.
Yeah.
And at the same time, as much as I need to add nutrition, mealtimes are very, very precious to me for obvious reasons. So I want to really enjoy them and feel satisfied. But there is a way of having both. There's certainly is, and I'm sort of living proof of that, really.
Yeah, so wonderful of you to join us here. It sounds delicious. We wish you the best.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And to get a copy of today's recipe or find out more about Sally's book and where to get it, visit our website at
ZorbaPastor.org. And while you're there, you can sign up for our weekly recipe podcast and search all of your favorite Zorba Pastor On Your Health recipes. That's ZorbaPastor.org.
That's 800-462-7413. And Zorba, we welcome a listener now in St. Louis, Missouri. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. How can we help you?
Well, I love your show, and I have a personal issue that I thought Zorba may be able to help me with.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a 9-year-old who just craves salt. She'll eat salt in just about any form. And she's been having some anxiety recently. And so I recall from the days in college, they used to treat mood disorders with salt. And I'm thinking there may be something associated with that.
Yeah.
I thought, let me call an expert and see what you have to say.
Let me just ask before Zorba, and he will have some good advice, I'm sure. You say she craves salt. What happens if you start cutting back on the salt in her food?
Then she'll sneak it. You know, she'll grab chips at school or popcorn at the movie. I mean, she just craves salt.
So, there's no realistic way you can really, by diet, take that salt away from her, you think?
Hmm? Well, you know, when we watch her, we pull the condiments off the table, but I'll give you for instance, we flew to visit her grandparents this week, and she licked the salt off the peanuts in the plane.
Well, she licked the salt off the peanuts in the plane and then didn't eat the peanuts. She just licked the salt.
And then spits out the peanuts, yes, absolutely.
And spits out the peanuts. Well, that's somebody who certainly wants a lot of salt. Where did you hear about mood disorders treated with salt? You remember reading something about that in college?
Well, when I was in college, I recall that they used to treat them with lithium and other salts. And I see.
That's where you got it. Well, lithium salts are different. I mean, that's a different...
Good.
Yes, lithium salts are not sodium. They're not sodium chloride. And we do treat mood disorders with lithium, and it is a salt, but it's not the same thing.
Okay.
This is an American problem, by the way. It's not really unique to your daughter. And the reason why there's sweet snacks and salty snacks is Americans crave sweet and salty. And frankly, they both compete for our taste buds. And we eat an enormous amount of them. I mean, you look at Americans, typically 40% of our calories, 40% of our calories come from snacks, half of those from salty snacks, half from sweet snacks, basically, somewhere around that. So then you look at the food we have. You look at French fries, they're filled with salt. You look at the typical cheeseburger, it's filled with salt, and of course it has sodium in the cheese and so on. And we eat about 50 to 100% more salt than we need.
Yeah.
And it's obviously not just taking the condiments off the table because she'll grab it somewhere else. But this is a problem with kids who are overweight, for kids who won't eat vegetables, for kids who will limit themselves to one or two foods a day, one or two different kinds of food. I remember we had a neighbor, and she would only eat something if it had bacon in it, and that's all. So everything had a bacon in, from vegetables to beef to anything else. And when she became an adult, it was awful because she had so limited her palate. And her parents basically said, well, she won't eat anything with bacon. And so they put bacon in everything. And so that is an issue with this. It's a tough issue, but it's sort of part of the educational issue. And I don't have an easy answer for you, but you've got to begin to work on it. And that's talking and having foods that don't have salt that are tasty. And then trying to, once again, if you don't cook, if you don't have prepared foods, you cut down on the sodium a lot. If you make food and you don't cook it with salt, but you allow salt on the surface, you're then tasting the salt, but you don't have the sodium within the food. And it's the salt that you taste at that first
time. And maybe you don't have the nuts on the airplane to give the opportunity.
Right. You just don't have the nuts. You know, those are things. And with a 9-year-old, you've got a lot more you've got a more reliable reputation than you do than with a 19-year-old. Good luck.
Very good.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Sure. We appreciate the call. Thank you. And before the break, Zorba, let's take another quick question from the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox for this installment of Traveling Tips from Zorba. Today's question is from Michael in Princeton, New Jersey. Michael deals with international cuisine. Michael writes, I'm writing to ask you about the safety of eating an Italian pasta dish called carbonara. Raw eggs are added to the pasta after it's been cooked and strained. I'm wondering if the heat from the pasta is sufficient to kill any harmful bacteria, such as salmonella, in the eggs. I will soon be going on a trip to Italy, and I know that I'll be very tempted to order this dish, one of my favorites, but if you suggest that it's best to avoid carbonara, then I will play it safe.
I love carbonara. It's one of the spaghetti carbonara is one of the things that I often served my kids just all the time. It was one of the standard foods that we had.
And I can't imagine getting along without raw eggs.
No, it's not raw. You put the eggs. In the pasta, and the pasta is steaming, and the steam from the pasta and the heat from the pasta cooks the eggs, and that's basically what it is. In other words, you have to mix it around. It's mixed it around so the eggs are actually cooked. You look so incredulous. It's actually how it's done. It's
no danger, right?
No danger in carbonara.
Yeah.
No danger in carbonara. Know that restaurant. You're going to Italy. You got to enjoy a little.
Okay. Before you travel abroad, make sure to check in with Public Radio's favorite family doc for our next edition of Traveling Tips from Zorba. Just send your question in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org and put travel in the subject line and we'll answer your question.
Okay. Some more research, some interesting research coming up. More of your calls, of course, and our medical myth buster here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That toll-free number again is 800-462-7413. But, Zorba, before our next call, some more troubling research on obese kids and heart risks.
Yes, very troubling. This is a study that looked at very obese kids in childhood. And it was a big study done from 2005 all the way through 2007. And looked at obese kids from the age of 2 to 18. Mm-hmm. They looked at the BMI, you know, the body mass index, which tells obesity. It was 20 for 2-year-olds. That's the number. 31, a lot of people know the BMI, for 12-year-olds, and 35 for 18-year-olds. So that would be, I mean, that's significantly obese. What they found was that 2 out of 3, 67%, had at least one cardiovascular risk factor. Half of them had high blood pressure. Half of them had an elevation of the bad cholesterol. 14% of them, 1 in 7, had a fasting blood sugar that was elevated, which puts them at a risk for diabetes. And even worse, 62% of those 12 and under had at least 2 risk factors for cardiovascular disease. By the time they were 12, they already had 2 risk factors.
Yeah, that sounds awful, except do we know if we tested non-obese kids, how many of those would some of those?
No, no. If you look at kids that are not obese, you don't find these risk factors at all. There's very good data that looks at cholesterol in normal age kids, blood pressure in normal. We've got lots of normals for blood pressure, cholesterol, and lipids in kids who are not that. No, we've got a ton of data on that. So when you compare it, normally kids have very low cholesterols. Their blood pressure is super low, and their blood sugar is super low and fine. Yeah, we have lots of data. These kids are basically showing the fact that they're already stressed by the age of 12 with their obesity. And it was rare years ago in my office to see kids who were, you know, who were basically 150, 200 pounds or 225. I see that all the time.
Yeah.
And often the parents are overweight and the kids are mimicking what the parents are doing and what they're eating.
Yeah, and I see here that one in three of these kids is from one-parent families.
That's right. So it also shows the stress of one-parent families. Here it is. You work. You come home from work. That's a very common thing. You feed what's easy, and what's easy is often food that has high sugar, high salt, high fat, and high carbohydrate, and high calories. Yeah. And that's what parents often do.
And
if it's one parent, it's more likely to happen.
What goes on here, I assume, is what we always talk about is eating and exercise.
Yeah, diet eating and exercise. Just, so, I mean, basically, what I think we have to do is we have to bring the bull by the horns, to use that particular image, and pull the plug. I'm all for pull the plug one or two nights in your family, and that means shut off everything electrically that you can look at that's entertaining, the television, the computer. Get out and move your body, and that may make a difference to you and help your children stay well.
1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number. You'll find a line open right now. And a listener now in Jacksonville, Florida. Hi.
Hello, gentlemen.
How can we help you?
Well, for several years, I've been getting these small blisters on my foot, and they're kind of unique for a couple of reasons. First, they end up going around the outer edge of my foot or inner edge, occasionally right in the middle of my foot, but they don't really spread all over the foot, just along the edges. And the second really strange thing is my left foot only. I never get them on my right foot, and they tend to itch a little bit. So what I usually do is I'll break them and wash my feet, and sometimes they'll last for a day or two and go away, and sometimes they'll last for a week or two and go away. There doesn't really seem to be any rhyme or reason about when they show up. I have a few pairs of shoes. I haven't been able to tie it down to one particular pair of shoes or socks or no socks or a time of the year. They're just really sort of befuddling.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask about shoes, and you answered that question, but you're calling from Jacksonville. Why don't you just go barefoot all the time?
As much as I'd like to, that's just not safe.
It's just not safe, Tom. That's
what I tell my children, so they always have to wear shoes. So Dad has to do the same thing.
Yeah. What sort of work do you do?
I'm a computer tech guy.
Okay, so you're not out working on a job where your feet sweat all the time in construction.
Because that's
a biggie, because often a lot of blisters that we have are really from friction that occur in the feet. What sort of socks do you wear?
Just regular athletic tube socks and then dress socks when I wear dress shoes.
Mm-hmm. Have you noticed a difference at all in the socks that you wear?
No.
Mm-hmm. Because sometimes socks can be the issue. If you wear a sock that has a layer, one layer, which is an athletic type sock that wicks moisture away from your feet, and it has, you know, another layer that's padding, that can make a difference in essentially in blisters that occur. Because this is a blister or a blister variation. Is it painful at all for you?
Not painful, just very itchy when they show up, and when they tend to grow in size. They'll start small, and then the next day it'll be a little larger. And they sort of, there's a point at which they reach a size where they just really itch.
Then they really itch.
That's when I tend to break them and wash my feet.
Yeah. How many times a month does this occur? Is it a monthly occurrence?
It isn't. I would say on average, if you averaged out a couple of years, it's probably happening every couple of months.
Okay. So
really no rhyme or reason.
I've got some recommendations. As soon as you feel like this is starting, what I would recommend doing is powdering your feet. I would do is I would go get some either a foot powder like Gold Bond, or I would get a talcum powder, powder your feet, and I would change the socks twice a day. I think it's a moisture issue, and I think if you attack the moisture issue right away, that'll be it. I'd look at the shoes that you're wearing too, because actually if you wear the same shoes day in and day out, sometimes there'll be too much moisture in the shoe itself, and the moisture then impacts the skin in the shoe. And sometimes just varying between two or three pairs of shoes will allow your shoes to dry out, because once again, if you want the shoes to be dry, because I think that's really the issue. You know, if that fails, what I do is talk to your doctor about a prescription, a steroid cream, triamcinolone, which is abbreviated as TMC cream. TMC cream is a very good cream that often works for irritations of the feet, and I would try that too. But I think first I'd hit the moisture with powder and socks, and as I said, change thy shoes, and don't go barefoot, even though Tom recommends it. Do not go barefoot.
Is there any explanation for why it's 1 foot?
No, I don't have any explanation. You might sweat more on one foot than the other. Some people, it's due to sweating, and there's a difference. I mean, my right hand is warmer than my left hand, and I don't have an explanation for it. I mean, our bodies are not always as symmetrical as we think.
Okay, excellent.
Well, thank you for the call.
I sure appreciate your help.
Bye-bye. Zorba, it's that time in the hour once again where we get to our medical myth buster. We have a listener myth today that deals with a topic we've discussed before on the show, but new Wisconsin resident Michael would like you to put your official word on it. He writes, "We just bought a home and we're thinking of buying an outdoor grill. I've heard that there can be a danger in consuming too much grilled meat in terms of the carcinogens. How much is too much, and what can we do to enjoy healthy grilling in our backyard?"
Well, first of all, the carcinogen issue has been around for a long time because we know that there are nitrosamines that are made when you grill meat. And so, you know, recommendations are don't eat grilled meat every day and use liquid smoke because then you don't grill the meat. And I take those recommendations with a grain of salt because I happen to like to grill meat and, you know, you can't worry about everything. On the other hand, there are ways that you can reduce that carcinogen issue by only essentially grilling out once or twice a week and using meat. If you're going to grill meat, first of all, vegetables will not have it. This tends to be animal fat, and the fatter the cut, the more you're likely to get it. So if you have boneless, skinless chicken breast, that's not going to have the same, quote, amount of carcinogens. If that's what your fear is, then you're going to have with a bratwurst.
Or tenderloin instead of
tenderloin. Yeah. Pork tenderloin. Good example. Now, there's also a claim that rosemary may actually reduce the toxins in grilled meat. And there was an article that came out this last March that used an extract of rosemary where they put the extract of rosemary on both sides it was a liquid that they put on both sides of the burger. And lo and behold, they had less nitrosamines that they actually were going to put, that they actually were able to measure. So it may turn out that it's not only how you cook the meat, but how you season the meat that counts too. So my recommendation is grill a couple times a week, and don't worry about it. There are more important things to worry about in life than barbecued food.
If you'd like to grill Zorba on a myth you'd like busted, just send it to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Our toll-free number is 800-462-7413. And Zorba, our next listener is on the line in Knoxville, Tennessee. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. How can we help you?
Well, I'm wondering about artificial sweeteners and the health effects. I've started drinking a lot of diet sodas and using those Splenda packets and things in coffee and tea, and I'm wondering if I need to worry about any health effects from them.
Zorba, I know we'll answer that one, but let me ask you first, why are you using the artificial as opposed to the sugar?
Well, just to save on calories and kind of cut down on sugar a little bit.
You know, one of the issues that's interesting is since the introduction of diet sodas, Americans have become heavier and heavier. And you would expect when NutraSweet came in and then Splenda came in that Americans would all of a sudden lose weight because they would be able to, you know, be able to crave their sweet tooth and not get the calories. And there's some people who theorize that when you eat sweet things and you don't actually have the calories, that your craving and your appetite goes up. In other words, that the sweetness, although it satisfies your taste buds, doesn't give you any calories and therefore doesn't satisfy you in another way, and you get the calories somewhere else, you know, because you want to. And I used to poo-poo that as a theory, and now I kind of wonder if it's true because as the consumption of diet soda goes up continuously, we have more. Now, Generally regarded as safe. That's what the FDA calls it. When we look at NutraSweet, NutraSweet is a protein. That's what it is. There are two amino acids linked together, and they taste sweet. And for years, it was blamed on everything from, you know, ADHD to autism to, I think, the weather. You know, I think that's basically what it was. It was incredibly studied. It's still incredibly studied. Is it healthy? Well, it's a non-nutrient. You know, it has no nutritional value at all. And as a result, you know, most people can tolerate it, except for people with phenylketonuria who cannot. That's an unusual disease. Splenda is derived from sugar. Same thing, generally regarded as safe by the FDA. Lots of studies on it. Nothing has ever been proven that it's abnormal. So I think these things should stay on the marketplace. And then people want to get it off the marketplace because they think it's not safe. But, I mean, we know sugar isn't safe in large amounts. We know fat isn't safe. We know a lot of things are not safe. So should you drink it? Well, the answer is, it's okay to drink, but I think what's better is to begin to acclimate yourself to a drink you like that isn't as sweet. So I think you're better off with, for instance, half-strength apple juice. You know, apple juice and club soda, half and half. Or quarter apple juice, three-quarters club soda. In other words, just like we have to acclimate ourselves to less salt, I think we're healthier if we begin to acclimate ourselves to something that's less sweet. And if we follow the sort of European model or the model of the Mediterranean Sea, where people eat better than we do, they don't have a lot of sweets. When they have something that's really sweet, it's an unusual event, and that's their treat. And I think that's a better way to go than just to have diet soda that's sweetened with artificial stuff.
Okay, thanks so much.
Sure, appreciate the call.
Good luck.
Apple juice and soda.
Yeah, have you ever had that?
Mm.
Oh, it actually is good. Obviously, it's not your style. It's not your style.
Before we drop the curtains on this episode, Zorba, we have a citation to address from Zorba Pastor on your health grammar, please. The complaint must have come over our Interpol wires because it's from international agent Michael, who is a member of the Finnish pronunciation police. Michael is citing your pronunciation of the word sauna. He writes, "Greatly enjoy your program, but sauna is not properly pronounced sauna, as is typical in most U.S. media. In Finnish, each letter is pronounced, though often a bit differently than in North American English. Sauna is pronounced closer to sauna, and closest,
sauna,
and closest to sauna.
Sauna.
With the S-O-U as in sound.
Now, I have a
sauna.
Sauna.
Did you get in the sauna?
Did you get
today?
I think if I say, did you get into the sauna, people wonder if I've had too much alcohol.
you don't buy the Finn version.
Well, I'm not Finnish. That's
they
all
should
I
know
can
about
say.
Saunas in Finland, I would think.
I think they probably do know about sauna. In Finland.
Well, don't you get overheated by Zorba's grammar mistake, or maybe not mistake. Just send him a citation. Send your citation in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
And if you missed anything during the show or just want to download our recipe podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org.
Don't forget, you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Our producer never sleeps. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. Adam Friedrich and Brad Kohlberg, the Don Draper and Roger Sterling of WPR, are the mad men in charge of this hour. Adam Friedrich is our executive producer. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark. Why don't you be with us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health?
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0825Z. More on healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, show archives, and listener feedback, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.